empower me to rise up, which is exactly what I did. I dumped that shake in the trash, laced up my shoes, and hit the streets again. On my first run, I felt severe pain in my legs and my lungs at a quarter mile. My heart raced and I stopped. This time I felt the same pain. My heart raced like a car running hot, but I ran through it and the pain faded. By the time I bent over to catch my breath, I'd run a full mile. That's when I first realized that not all physical and mental limitations are real, and that I had a habit of giving up way too soon. I also knew that it would take every ounce of courage and toughness I could muster to pull off the impossible. I was staring at hours, days, and weeks of nonstop suffering. I would have to push myself to the very edge of my mortality. I had to accept the very real possibility that I might die, because this time I wouldn't quit, no matter how fast my heart raced, and no matter how much pain I was in. Trouble was, there was no battle plan to follow. No blueprint. I had to create one from scratch. The typical day went something like this. I'd wake up at 4:30 a.m., munch a banana, and hit the ASVAB books. Around 5 a.m., I'd take that book to my stationary bike, where I'd sweat and study for 2 hours. Remember, my body was a mess. I couldn't run multiple miles yet, so I had to burn as many calories as I could on the bike. After that, I'd drive over to Carmel High School and jump into the pool for a 2-hour swim. From there, I hit the gym for a circuit workout that included the bench press, the incline press, and lots of leg exercises. Bulk was the enemy. I needed reps, and I did 5 or 6 sets of 100 to 200 reps each. Then it was back to the stationary bike for 2 more hours. I was constantly hungry. Dinner was my one true meal each day, but there wasn't much to it. I ate a grilled or sautéed chicken breast and some sautéed vegetables along with a thimble of rice. After dinner, I'd do another 2 hours on the bike, hit the sack, wake up, and do it all over again, knowing the odds were stacked sky high against me. What I was trying to achieve is like a D student applying to Harvard, or walking into a casino and putting every single dollar you own on a number in roulette and acting as if winning is a foregone conclusion. I was betting everything I had on myself with no guarantees. I weighed myself twice daily, and within 2 weeks I dropped 25 pounds. My progress only improved as I kept grinding, and the weight started peeling off. 10 days later, I was at 250, light enough to begin doing push-ups, pull-ups, and to start running my ass off. I'd still wake up, hit the stationary bike, the pool, and the gym, but I also incorporated 2, 3, and 4-mile runs. I ditched my running shoes and ordered a pair of Bates Lights, the same boots SEAL candidates wear in Buds, and started running in those. With so much effort, you'd think my nights would have been restful, but they were filled with anxiety. My stomach growled and my mind swirled. I'd dream of complex ASVAB questions and dread the next day's workouts. I was putting out so much on almost no fuel that depression became a natural side effect. My splintering marriage was veering toward divorce. Pam made it very clear that she and my stepdaughter would not be moving to San Diego with me, if by some miracle I could pull this off. They stayed in Brazil most of the time, and when I was all alone in Carmel, I was in turmoil. I felt both worthless and helpless as my endless stream of self-defeating thoughts picked up steam. When depression smothers you, it blots out all light and leaves you with nothing to cling onto for hope. All you see is negativity. For me, the only way to make it through that was to feed off my depression. I had to flip it and convince myself that all that self-doubt and anxiety was confirmation that I was no longer living an aimless life. My task may turn out to be impossible, but at least I was back on a motherfucking mission. Some nights when I was feeling low, I'd call Shaljo. He was always in the office early in the morning and late at night. I didn't confide in him about my depression because I didn't want him to doubt me. I used those calls to pump myself up. I told him how many pounds I dropped and how much work I was putting in, and he reminded me to keep studying for that ASVAB. Roger that. I had the Rocky soundtrack on cassette, and I'd listen to Going the Distance for inspiration. On long bike rides and runs, with those horns blasting in my brain, I'd imagine myself going through Buds, diving into cold water, and crushing Hell Week. I was wishing, I was hoping. But by the time I was down to 250, my quest to qualify for the SEALs wasn't a daydream anymore. I had a real chance to accomplish something most people, including myself, thought was impossible. Still, there were bad days. One morning, not long after I dipped below 250, I weighed in, and I'd only lost a pound from the day before. I had so much weight to lose, I could not afford to plateau. That's all I thought about while running 6 miles and swimming too. I was exhausted and sore when I arrived in the gym for my typical 3-hour circuit. After rocking over 100 pull-ups in a series of sets, I was back on the bar for a max set with no ceiling. Going in, my goal was to get to 12, but my hands were burning fire as I stretched my chin over the bar for the 10th time. For weeks, the temptation to pull back had been ever-present, and I always refused. That day, however, the pain was too much, and after my 11th pull-up, I gave in, dropped down, and finished my workout, one pull-up shy. That one rep stayed with me, along with that 1 pound. I tried to get them out of my head, but they wouldn't leave me the fuck alone. They taunted me on the drive home and at my kitchen table while I ate a sliver of grilled chicken and a bland baked potato. I knew I wouldn't sleep that night unless I did something about it, so I grabbed my keys. "You cut corners and you are not gonna fucking make it," I said out loud as I drove back to the gym. "There are no shortcuts for you, Goggins." I did my entire pull-up workout over again. One missed pull-up cost me an extra $2.50, and there would be similar episodes. Whenever I cut a run or swim short because I was hungry or tired, I'd always go back and beat myself down even harder. That was the only way I could manage the demons in my mind. Either way, there would be suffering. I had to choose between physical suffering in the moment and the mental anguish of wondering if that one missed pull-up, that last lap in the pool, the quarter mile I skipped on the road or trail, would end up costing me an opportunity of a lifetime. It was an easy choice. When it came to the SEALs, I wasn't leaving anything up to chance. On the eve of the ASVAB, with 4 weeks to go before training, making weight was no longer a worry. I was already down to 215 pounds and was faster and stronger than I'd ever been. I was running 6 miles a day, bicycling over 20 miles, and swimming more than 2, all of it in the dead of winter. My favorite run was the 6-mile Monon Trail, an asphalt bike and walking path that laced through the trees in Indianapolis. It was the domain of cyclists and soccer moms with jogging strollers, weekend warriors and seniors. By then, Shaljo had passed along the Navy SEAL warning order. It included all the workouts I would be expected to complete during the first phase of BUDS, and I was happy to double them. I knew that 190 men usually class up for a typical SEAL training, and only about 40 people make it all the way through. I didn't want to be just one of those 40. I wanted to be the best. But I had to pass the damn ASVAB first. I'd been cramming every spare second. If I wasn't working out, I was at my kitchen table, memorizing formulas and cycling through hundreds of vocabulary words. With my physical training going well, all my anxieties stuck to the ASVAB like paper clips to a magnet. This would be my last chance to take the test before my eligibility for the SEALs expired. I wasn't very smart, and based on past academic performance, there was no good reason to believe I'd pass with a score high enough to qualify for the SEALs. If I failed, my dream would die, and I'd be floating without purpose once again. The test was held in a small classroom on Fort Benjamin Harrison in Indianapolis. There were about 30 people there, all of us young. Most were just out of high school. We were each assigned an old-school desktop computer. In the past month, the test had been digitized, and I wasn't experienced with computers. I didn't even think I could work the damn machine, let alone answer the questions. But the program proved idiot-proof, and I settled in. The ASVAB has 10 sections, and I was breezing through until I reached mechanical comprehension, my truth serum. Within the hour, I would have a decent idea if I'd been lying to myself, or if I had the raw stuff necessary to become a SEAL. Whenever a question stumped me, I marked my worksheet with a dash. There were about 30 questions in that section, and by the time I completed the test, I'd guessed at least 10 times. I needed some of them to go my way, or I was out. After completing the final section, I was prompted to send the entire bundle to the administrator's computer at the front of the room, where the score would be tabulated instantly. I peeked over my monitor and saw him sitting there, waiting. I pointed, clicked, and left the room. Buzzing with nervous energy, I paced the parking lot for a few minutes before finally ducking into my Honda Accord, but I didn't start the engine. I couldn't leave. I sat in the front seat for 15 minutes with a 1,000-yard stare. It would be at least 2 days before Shaljo would call with my results, but the answer to the riddle that was my future was already solved. I knew exactly where it was, and I had to know the truth. I gathered myself, walked back in, and approached the fortune teller. "You gotta tell me what I got on this fucking test, man," I said. He peered up at me, surprised, but he didn't buckle. "I'm sorry, son. This is the government. There's a system for how they do things, he said. I didn't make the rules, and I can't bend them. Sir, you have no idea what this test means to me, to my life. It's everything. He looked into my glassy eyes for what felt like 5 minutes, then turned toward his machine. I'm breaking every rule in the book right now, he said. Goggins, right? I nodded and came around behind his seat as he scrolled through files. There you are. Congratulations. You scored 65. That's a great score. He was referencing my overall, but I didn't care about that. Everything hinged on my getting a 50 spot where it counted most. What did I get on mechanical comprehension? He shrugged, clicked, and scrolled, and there it was. My new favorite number glowed on his screen. 50. Yes! I shouted. Yes! Yes! There were still a handful of others taking the test, but this was the happiest moment in my life, and I couldn't stifle it. I kept screaming, yes, at the top of my lungs. The administrator damn near fell out of his chair, and everyone in that room stared at me like I was crazy. If they only knew how crazed I'd been. For 2 months, I dedicated my entire existence toward this one moment, and I was damn well going to enjoy it. I rushed to my car and screamed some more. Fuck yeah! On my drive home, I called my mom. She was the one person, aside from Shaljo, who witnessed my metamorphosis. I fucking did it, I told her, tears in my eyes. I fucking did it! I'm going to be a SEAL! When Shaljo came to work the next day, he got the news and called me up. He'd sent in my recruitment package and had just heard back that I was in. I could tell he was happy for me and proud that what he saw in me the first time we met turned out to be real. But it wasn't all happy days. My wife had given me an implied ultimatum, and now I had a decision to make. Abandon the opportunity I'd worked so hard for and stay married, or get divorced and go try and become a SEAL. In the end, my choice didn't have anything to do with my feelings for Pam or her father. He'd apologized to me, by the way. It was about who I was and who I wanted to be. I was a prisoner in my own mind, and this opportunity was my only chance to break free. I celebrated my victory the way any SEAL candidate should. I put the fuck out. The following morning, and for the next 3 weeks, I spent time in the pool, strapped with a 16-pound weight belt. I swam underwater for 50 meters at a time, and walked the length of the pool underwater with a brick in each hand, all in a single breath. The water would not own my ass this time. When I was done, I'd swim a mile or two, then head to a pond near my mother's home. Remember, this was Indiana, the American Midwest, in December. The trees were naked. Icicles hung like crystals from the eaves of houses, and snow blanketed the earth in all directions. But the pond wasn't completely frozen yet. I waded into the icy water, dressed in camo pants, a brown short-sleeved t-shirt, and boots, laid back and looked into the gray sky. The hypothermic water washed over me. The pain was excruciating, and I fucking loved it. After a few minutes, I got out and started running, water sloshing in my boots, sand in my underwear. Within seconds, my t-shirt was frozen to my chest, my pants iced at the cuffs. I hit the Monon Trail. Steam poured from my nose and mouth as I grunted and slalomed speedwalkers and joggers. Civilians. Their heads turned as I picked up speed and began sprinting like Rocky in downtown Philly. I ran as fast as I could, for as long as I could. From a past that no longer defined me, toward a future undetermined. All I knew was that there would be pain, and there would be purpose. And that I was ready. That was an impossible task.
You know what, man? When I hear you read that, still to this day, it makes me very emotional. And like that scene with me taking the ASVAB test and me walking back out to the car and me walking around and then me getting in my car, then me coming back in and literally begging the guy. I mean, I was literally almost crying because my whole life was just sitting on that 50.
Mm.
And so what people never, you know, we did a good job of making that scene as powerful as it is. But, you know, this whole book of mine, it went to auction as you know, Adam. And that scene that you just read, this chapter that you just read, this is one of the main reasons why, you know, I got offered $300,000 for my book.
Mm.
And that chapter that you just read is a major reason why I couldn't sell my life to anybody. Going back through, listening to you, you know, just pretty much read my life story in that section. And there's so much more things to come. It made me realize why this is the only trophy. This is the only trophy that I would truly, you know, have in my life. And that chapter is where this really started for me. I started really figuring out what life was all about. You know, I didn't figure it out completely, but you know, you talking that, you know, you reading that story, it lets me know why there wasn't any amount of money that I was going to take for the shit I put myself through to be where I'm at today.
It's very interesting. I want to go on record as saying I encourage you to take that book deal, which is the wrong decision. Right. As we'll soon know, it would have been the wrong decision. So
right.
never listen to me about business. But I will say that, I could understand it because it seems to me that you were in not just a physical bunker mentality, but a mental and emotional bunker mentality. Yeah, your mom could penetrate the bunker a little bit, but really you had to be in your own bunker.
Right.
And that's a very lonely and isolating place to be. I mean, going through this journey with you and hearing what you had to go through, you know, my heart goes out to you because you had basically put it all on this. Now, you know, you might have come out of this, if you failed, we don't know what would have happened. Would all of that hard work dissipated? Would you have had to go back and get some wage job? Would you have never achieved anything? We don't really know. But in your mind at that moment, you couldn't afford that. Like there was, you know, you didn't have the slack to give yourself.
Right.
You know, you had to go forward. You had to do this or the odds were you were going to be the statistic you were always supposed to be.
And that was the hard part about this was I couldn't give myself even just like a little break.
Yeah.
And there was sometimes I would literally look at my running shoes for 30 to 40 minutes because when you're that big, I mean, I was so broken every single day, you know.
Yeah.
I would literally look at all these. Okay, now I would get done running 6 miles and know I had, you know, 2 hours on the bike and then there are 2 hours at nighttime and I had to go swim 2 more miles and I had 3 hours in the gym. And just knowing that there was every single fucking day you were going to have to relive this hell. And there were some days I couldn't even get out of bed. I was so sore. And then to know that I had to get out of bed and literally like for the first hour and a half, you know, my body just didn't want to move and to force it.
Is it hard to also study and kind of do the hard intellectual work while you're sore like that? That must be really hard, right? I mean, it's not a break.
Well, that's what sucked for me also was I was literally so I had to earn. I never sat down. I had to always earn my right to watch TV. So how I did that was I got a stationary bike, put it in my house, an old cheap Walmart stationary bike, and I would be there and I had I kind of propped up some, you know, those like little eating tables and I put my books on there and I was just studying and I would study all, I was so obsessed. And that's one thing I talk about when I tell people about motivation. I always say motivation is crap. And people go, you know, how do you say that? All it is, you know, it's just a little bit of kindling. That's all it is. You know, you have to be like for instance, some people are going to read this book and be so fucking motivated and they're going to have a bad day. And on that bad day, their motivation is going to be fucking gone. It's going to be gone. So I realized about the human mind that I had to be more than motivated. I had to be more than driven. I had to become literally obsessed to the point where people thought I was fucking nuts. You know, like the colder it was, the better it was. The more I suffered, the more I had to just literally take all of this stuff and wrap it up and just be like, okay, fuck it. This is what's going to happen now. And I had to start really just callousing my mind.
It's, you know, just reading these chapters that we read today, and for listeners, we're being super transparent. We're recording this over a period of 5 days. And these first three chapters are done in the first session. And, you know what I think is so interesting about this book and your life? It's the way you crack stereotypes. And I'm not talking about ethnic stereotypes. I'm talking about you know, Sister Catherine, how you don't, you're never going to judge a smile or a scowl.
Right.
You know, it's the same idea when I hear this. It's like, we don't know what the people that we interact with in our hometowns and the cities that we live in, what they're going through. And, you know, I could picture you, in bunker mentality, not giving anybody any smiles, being all business, and people taking that personally, when in reality, you're trying to do something really important for yourself. And it's all about your own journey, and you didn't have any hate towards anybody else.
Right.
And that's, and there's people out there all the time going through what they're going through, and it, you just can't judge it. And it's very interesting. That's what I love about what you do, because I think that you kind of recalibrate, what we expect from people.
Right.
And how to appreciate people.
And see, even now, you know, you guys have heard my story, at least a fraction of it, about how I got called nigger. And, you know, I hate no one. I dislike some people just because of some issues that we have. You know, when you are constantly judged your whole life, when you are, as we call it in the book, the only your whole life, how the fuck am I now going to walk around in my, you know, in this world I live in and judge anybody? Because I know how it feels to be judged. And we're so stupid. It's so many people who have been judged. They now judge other people. We forget how it feels to be the only person, how it feels to be judged. I don't forget it. I remember, so I'm all about people being whoever the hell they are, be it, own it, wear it like a fucking badge of honor.
Love it. And so the next challenge is, it's kind of the first step on the journey towards callousing your mind. That's how we start the next challenge. And that's what this was, right? This is where you really started to callous your mind, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah, for sure. This is when I started literally trying to callous over that whole victim's mentality.
Challenge 3. The first step on the journey toward a calloused mind is stepping outside your comfort zone on a regular basis. Dig out your journal again and write down all the things you don't like to do or that make you uncomfortable, especially those things you know are good for you. Now go do one of them, and do it again. In the coming pages, I'll be asking you to mirror what you just read to some degree, but there is no need for you to find your own impossible task and achieve it on the fast track. This is not about changing your life instantly. It's about moving the needle bit by bit and making those changes sustainable. That means digging down to the micro level and doing something that sucks every day. Even if it's as simple as making your bed, doing the dishes, ironing your clothes, or getting up before dawn and running 2 miles each day. Once that becomes comfortable, take it to 5, then 10 miles. If you already do all those things, find something you aren't doing. We all have areas in our lives we either ignore or can improve upon. Find yours. We often choose to focus on our strengths rather than our weaknesses. Use this time to make your weaknesses your strengths. Doing things, even small things, that make you uncomfortable will help make you strong. The more often you get uncomfortable, the stronger you'll become, and soon you'll develop a more productive, can-do dialogue with yourself in stressful situations. Take a photo or video of yourself in the discomfort zone, post it on social media describing what you're doing and why, and don't forget to include the hashtags. Hashtag discomfort zone. Hashtag path of most resistance. Hashtag can't hurt me. Hashtag impossible task. So this one, you're not giving them a specific thing. You're asking them to look inside and figure out what they don't like to do. This is about really getting out of your comfort zone, because that's what you had to do when you were kind of in your own fugue state with no purpose.
Right. You know, one question I get all the time is, man, how did you become so damn mentally strong? How did you do this? I think everybody knows the answer. Everybody knows the answer, but they would love for me to give you a nice, simple, hey, it really is easy. That's what they want to hear. But the truth of the matter is this, man. Honestly, the only way you are ever going to become hard and learn to callous your mind is you have to do the things that you do not want to do. There's no way around it. Like a lot of people, if you like running, They will run. They'll just keep on running. I'm not saying don't do things you don't enjoy, but I'm saying that if you're looking for the advantage, if you're trying to get the advantage, you have to do those things that kind of make you say, oh man, I really don't want to do this shit right now.
Hmm.
I that, that's going to really challenge me mentally, physically, emotionally, spiritually. Those are the things you have to start gravitating to. Like a lot of people say, triple down on your strengths. Yeah, that's good for some things. But if you want to fucking really get hard and become that hardened person and get true mental toughness, you have to triple down on your weaknesses. And that's the only way you can start to callous that mind and start callousing over all of that. You know, you have to learn to callous over that victim's mentality.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when people say triple down on your strengths, they're basically implying pick a lane, do that, become an expert in one thing. But you're not talking to people about what you went through to make them an expert in anything. Your whole thing about callousing the mind, becoming better, is to make them a more unbreakable human being. And that's emotionally and physically and mentally. And I think that that's a very different thing. And don't you think that's your purpose? I mean, you're not trying to get someone to become the best this or that.
No.
I mean, that's shallow, really, if you think about
it. It's 100% shallow. And once again, you know, you're listening to my story right now. This isn't about me. This is about me challenging you to look inward and to start, you know, developing that hero inside of you. And these are all steps for you to, you know, not even steps. These are things for you to take on board in your life and think about, you know what? I could be doing more. I am afraid of this. I don't want to do that. You know, so just look at yourself and start challenging yourself even more.
You know, you saying that makes me think of something else, is that we've talked about this before, and that is, you know, all of this thing, this great task that you just accomplished in this chapter, that didn't give you anything really other than another opportunity to fail.
You know what? That's 100% correct, man. Like, you know, losing. So it wasn't like Stephen Saljo came, you know, miracled me and said, hey, man, if you lose 106 pounds and you pass the ASVAB, I'm going to miracle Navy SEAL Trident on your chest.
No.
You know, this was all a chance. And that's the thing about life, is a lot of us are not, if we're not guaranteed something, we don't want to take that chance. We're looking at it like, right now I could easily sat back and said, oh my God, losing 106 pounds? There's not even, you know, I may not even graduate BUDS, or, you know, retake the ASVAB test. I may not even graduate BUDS. If that is your mindset and that is your thinking, you have already lost. You have already lost. All this you have to put yourself in a position to win. Some of us don't even want to put ourselves in a position to win. So I knew losing 106 pounds, taking the ASVAB test again, was just me putting myself in a position to succeed. But most of us don't have the courage to put ourselves in a position to win. Why? Because failing is almost too much to handle. So why even try? Why even try? Because if I never tried, I can never fail. So that's the mindset of a lot of people.
But you know, in this case, it's not just a small risk. First of all, you're preparing to walk away from your marriage.
Right.
And the success rate for a SEAL and BUDS is 20%.
Exactly.
And so you do all this, you put all this out, and now you have a 20% chance of taking the next step. I mean, you still had a lot on the line and a lot ahead of you.
But you know what the beauty of that is, Adam? Is I had so much on the line and so much ahead of me, but what was happening when I was losing that weight and I was passing the ASVAB and I was going through all these daily struggles, I started finding a whole new David Goggins. Mm. That was the power of all this. My confidence started growing. So if you can lose 106 pounds in 3 months, what the fuck else can I do? Mm. If I can go back and retake the ASVAB and fail and fail and fail, and continue to, you know, strive for excellence in failure, all that was doing for me was making me more and more psyched up to be better. So I was just constantly fueling the machine. So even though it wasn't guaranteed I was going to get through SEAL training, my chances were looking pretty fucking good.
So, before we get into some stuff from Buds, which I'm really excited to share with the readers, I know you are, let's just recap that, because what you're talking about here is mindset. Isn't that right?
Exactly. It's all about mindset, and throughout this whole book, you're going to realize that it's going to always come back to one thing, mindset, and it's your mindset. It's how you speak to yourself, and it's also where you want to be at.
So that means constantly monitoring what you're thinking and so that you're controlling it. You know, I always think about don't believe everything you feel, because sometimes you might feel a certain way about some person or about some situation, but that first feeling isn't necessarily going to get you anything. It's not going to be a solution. It's usually something to ignore, wouldn't you say?
Oh, 100%. Life is all about feelings, and a lot of times we create this reality, and it's a false reality. And we live in this false reality, and it starts to control our lives. And it takes a really strong person. It has to come from you. You have to create. It's not creating at all. You have to go to the real reality. Sometimes it's not as bad as you've made it out to be. And, you know, it all comes when, you know, for instance, like, basically life is relentless. It just keeps coming at you, man. So you gotta be, you know, be prepared for it.
You know, I was reading yesterday, Nelson Mandela on his way out of prison. You know, he was wrongfully imprisoned for, 20 years or more. I forget exactly the number, decades, by white supremacists in South Africa. And on his way out, he knew, he's written about this. He knew he had to leave the bitterness behind him or he'd never be free.
Exactly.
And that's mindset, isn't it?
It's 100% mindset. Like, for instance, life is going to constantly come at you. So we have to control the things we can control. Like, for instance, this morning, I woke up this morning and we got out of here pretty late yesterday. And I went home, got back to the room about, you know, midnight and did my 2-hour stretching. And I woke up at about 6 o'clock this morning and went for a 7-mile run. I do all these things, not because I enjoy them, because I know once I leave my house, a lot of things are out of my control. So I am trying to, like, win these small battles, win these, you know, try to just have these small victories that I can take with me outside. So once I leave my house, if I've gotten up in the morning and I've, you know, done my routine as far as like going for a run, doing my push-ups, doing my pull-ups, I am basically trying to prepare my mind for the challenges that are going to come my way that I cannot control. So you always have to always constantly start to kind of get your mind ready for what's to come.
Perfect. And I think that's the perfect transition into Taking Souls, the next chapter. Just so you guys are clued in, this is day 2 here in the recording studio. It's a beautiful day outside, and we are in separate dark cubicles wired together.
Yes, man. I am back in the box.
We're in the box.
We're in the box, man. Nothing in life is going to, you know, it's not going to be ideal. We are always looking for an ideal situation. Everything has to be perfect for us to succeed. That is not what it's about. We have to be super, we have to be great in a situation that is not always perfect.
And if there's one thing about Hell Week, is it wasn't perfect, was it?
No, it was never perfect, but you had to find something more. That's what Taking Souls is all about. You had to find strength when there was no strength around. You had to, so sometimes you had to invent strength.
Chapter 4, Taking Souls. The first concussion grenade exploded at close range, and from there, everything unraveled in slow motion. 1 minute, we were chilling in the common room, bullshitting, watching war movies, getting pumped up for the battle we knew was coming. Then that first explosion led to another, and suddenly Psycho Pete was in our faces, screaming at the top of his lungs. His cheeks flushed candy apple red, that vein in his right temple throbbing. When he screamed, his eyes bugged out, and his whole body shook. Break the fuck out!
Move! Move! Move!
My boat crew sprinted for the door single file, just like we'd planned. Outside, Navy SEALs were firing their M60s into the darkness, towards some invisible enemy. It was the bad dream we'd been waiting for our entire lives, the lucid nightmare that would define or kill us. Every impulse we had told us to hit the dirt, but at that moment, movement was our only option. The repetitive, deep bass thud of machine gun fire penetrated our guts. The orange halo from another explosion in the near distance provided a shock of violent beauty, and our hearts hammered as we gathered on the grinder, awaiting orders. This was war, all right, but it wouldn't be fought on some foreign shore. This one, like most battles we fight in life, would be won or lost in our own minds. Psycho Pete stomped the pocked asphalt, his brow slick with sweat, the muzzle of his rifle steaming in the foggy night. "Welcome to Hell Week, gentlemen," he said, calmly this time, in that sing-song Cali surfer drawl of his. He looked us up and down like a predator eyeing his kill. "It will be my great pleasure to watch you suffer." Oh, and there would be suffering. Psycho set the tempo, called out the push-ups, sit-ups, and flutter kicks, the jumping lunges and dive bombers. In between, he and his fellow instructors hosed us down with freezing water, cackling the whole damn time. There were countless reps and set after set, with no end in sight. My classmates were gathered close, each of us on our own stenciled frog footprints, overlooked by a statue of our patron saint, the Frogman, a scaly alien creature from the deep, with webbed feet and hands, sharp claws, and a motherfucking six-pack. To his left was the infamous brass bell. Ever since that morning when I came home from cockroach duty and got sucked into the Navy SEAL show, it was this place that I'd sought. The grinder. A slab of asphalt dripping with history and misery. Bud's training is 6 months long and divided into three phases. First phase is all about physical training, or PT. Second phase is dive training, where we learn how to navigate underwater and deploy stealthy, closed-circuit diving systems that emit no bubbles and recycle our carbon dioxide into breathable air. Third phase is land warfare training. But when most people picture buds, they think of first phase, because those are the weeks that tenderize new recruits, until the class is literally ground down from about 120 guys to the hard, gleaming spine that are the 25 to 40 guys who are more worthy of the trident, the emblem that tells the world we are not to be fucked with. Bud's instructors do that by working guys out beyond their perceived limits, by challenging their manhood and insisting on objective physical standards of strength, stamina, and agility, standards that are tested. In those first 3 weeks of training, we had to, among other things, climb a vertical 10-meter rope, hammer a half-mile-long obstacle course studded with American Ninja Warrior-type challenges in under 10 minutes, and run 4 miles on the sand in under 32 minutes. But if you ask me, all that was child's play. It couldn't even compare to the crucible of first phase. Hell Week is something entirely different. It's medieval, and it comes at you fast, detonating in just the third week of training. When the throbbing ache in our muscles and joints was ratcheted up high, and we lived day and night with an edgy, hyperventilating feeling of our breath getting out front of our physical rhythm, of our lungs inflating and deflating, like canvas bags squeezed tight in a demon's fists, for 130 hours straight. That's a test that goes way beyond the physical, and reveals your heart and character. More than anything, it reveals your mindset, which is exactly what it's designed to do. All of this happened at the Naval Special Warfare Command Center on prissy-ass Coronado Island, a Southern California tourist trap that tucks into slender Point Loma and shelters the San Diego Marina from the open Pacific Ocean. But even Cali's golden sun couldn't pretty up the grinder, and thank God for that. I liked it ugly. That slab of agony was everything I'd ever wanted. Not because I loved to suffer, but because I needed to know whether or not I had what it took to belong. Thing is, most people don't. By the time Hell Week started, at least 40 guys had already quit, and when they did, they were forced to walk over to the bell, ring it 3 times, and place their helmet on the concrete. The ringing of the bell was first brought in during the Vietnam era because so many guys were quitting during evolutions and just walking off to the barracks. The bell was a way to keep track of guys, but since then it's become a ritual that a man has to perform to own the fact that he's quitting. To the quitter, the bell is closure. To me, every clang sounded like progress. I never liked Psycho much, but I couldn't quibble with the specifics of his job. He and his fellow instructors were there to cull the herd. Plus, he wasn't going after the runts. He was in my face plenty, and guys bigger than me, too. Even the smaller dudes were studs. I was one man in a fleet of alpha specimens from back east and down south. The blue-collar and big-money surf beaches of California, a few from corn country like me, and plenty from the Texas rangeland. Every Bud's class has their share of hard-ass backcountry Texans. No state puts more seals in the pipeline. Must be something in the barbecue, but Psycho didn't play favorites. No matter where we were from or who we were, he lingered like a shadow we couldn't shake, laughing, screaming, or quietly taunting us to our face, attempting to burrow into the brain of any man he tried to break. Despite all that, the first hour of Hell Week was actually fun. During breakout, that mad rush of explosions, shooting, and shouting, you are not even thinking about the nightmare to come. You're riding an adrenaline high because you know you're fulfilling a rite of passage within a hallowed warrior tradition. Guys are looking around the grinder, practically giddy, thinking, yeah, we're in Hell Week, motherfuckers. Ah, but reality has a way of kicking everyone in the teeth sooner or later. You call this putting out? Psycho Pete asked no one in particular. This may be the single sorriest class we ever put through our program. You men are straight up embarrassing yourselves. He relished this part of the job, stepping over and between us, his boot print in our pooling sweat and saliva, snot, tears, and blood. He thought he was hard. All the instructors did. And they were, because they were SEALs. That fact alone placed them in rare air. You boys couldn't have held my jock when I went through Hell Week, I'll tell you that much. I smiled to myself and kept hammering as Psycho brushed by. He was built like a tailback, quick and strong. But was he a mortal fucking weapon during his Hell Week? Sir, I doubt that very fucking much, sir. He caught the eye of his boss, the first phase officer in charge. There was no doubt about him. He didn't talk a whole lot, and didn't have to. He was 6'1", but he cast a longer shadow. Dude was jacked, too. I'm talking about 225 pounds of muscle, wrapped tight as steel, without an ounce of sympathy. He looked like a silverback gorilla, and loomed like a godfather of pain, making silent calculations, taking mental notes. Sir, my dick's getting stiff just thinking about these gaping vaginas, weeping and quitting like whiny little bitches this week, Psycho said. SBG offered half a nod as Psycho stared through me. Oh, and you will quit, he said softly. I'll make sure of that. Psycho's threats were spookier when he delivered them in a relaxed tone like that, but there were plenty of times when his eyes went dark, his brow twisted, the blood rushed to his face, and he unleashed a scream that built from the tips of his toes to the crown of his bald head. An hour into Hell Week, he knelt down, pressed his face within an inch of my own while I finished another set of push-ups, and let loose. Hit the surf, you miserable fucking turds! We'd been in Buds for nearly 3 weeks by then, and we'd raced up and over the 15-foot berm that divided the beach from the cinderblock sprawl of offices, locker rooms, barracks, and classrooms that is the Buds compound, plenty of times. Usually to lie back in the shallows, fully dressed, then roll in the sand, until we were covered in sand from head to toe, before charging back to the grinder, dripping heavy with salt water and sand, which ramped up the degree of difficulty on the pull-up bar. That ritual was called getting wet and sandy, and they wanted sand in our ears, up our noses, and in every orifice of our body. But this time we were on the verge of something called surf torture, which is a special kind of beast. As instructed, we charged into the surf, screaming like senseis. Fully clothed, arms linked, we waded into the impact zone. The surf was angry that moonless night, nearly head high, and the waves were rolling thunder that barreled and foamed in sets of 3 and 4. Cold water shriveled our balls and swiped the breath from our lungs as the waves thrashed us. This was early May, and in the spring, the ocean off Coronado ranges from 59 to 63 degrees. We bobbed up and down as one, a pearl strand of floating heads scanning the horizon for any hint of swell we prayed we'd see coming before it towed us under. The surfers in our crew detected doom first and called out the waves so we could duck dive just in time. After 10 minutes or so, Psycho ordered us back to land. On the verge of hypothermia, we scrambled from the surf zone and stood at attention while being checked by the doctor for hypothermia. That cycle would continue to repeat itself. The sky was smeared orange and red. The temperature dropped sharply as night loomed close. "Say goodbye to the sun, gents," SBG said. He made us wave at the setting sun, a symbolic acknowledgement of an inconvenient truth. We were about to freeze our natural asses off. After an hour, we fell back into our six-man boat cruise and stood nut to butt, huddling tight to get warm, but it was futile. Bones were rattling up and down that beach. Guys were jackhammering and sniffling, a physical state revealing the quaking conditions of splintering minds, which were just now coming to grips with the reality that this shit had only just begun. Even on the hardest days of first phase, prior to Hell Week, when the sheer volume of rope climbs and push-ups, pull-ups and flutter kicks crushes your spirit, you can find a way out, because you know that no matter how much it sucks, you'll head home that night, meet friends for dinner, see a movie, maybe get some pussy, and sleep in your own bed. The point is, even on miserable days, you can fixate on an escape from hell that's real. Hell Week offers no such love, especially on day one, when an hour in they had us standing, linking arms, facing the Pacific Ocean, waiting in and out of the surf for hours. In between, we were gifted soft sand sprints to warm up. Usually they had us carry our rigid inflatable boat or a log overhead. But the warmth, if it ever arrived, was always short-lived, because every 10 minutes they rotated us back into the water. The clock ticked slowly that first night as the cold seeped in, colonizing our marrow so thoroughly the run stopped doing any good. There would be no more bombs, no more shooting, and very little yelling. Instead, an eerie quiet expanded and deadened our spirit. In the ocean, all any of us could hear were the waves going overhead, the seawater we accidentally swallowed roiling in our guts, and our own teeth chattering. When you're that cold and stressed, the mind cannot comprehend the next 120-plus hours. 5.5 days without sleep cannot be broken up into small pieces. There is no way to systematically attack it, which is why every single person who has ever tried to become a SEAL has asked himself one simple question during their first dose of surf torture. Why am I here? Those innocuous words bubbled up in our spinning minds each time we got sucked under a monster wave at midnight, when we were already borderline hypothermic. Because nobody has to become a SEAL. We weren't fucking drafted. Becoming a SEAL is a choice. And what that single softball question revealed in the heat of battle is that each second we remained in training was also a choice, which made the entire notion of becoming a SEAL seem like masochism. It's voluntary torture, and that makes no sense at all to the rational mind, which is why those four words unravel so many men. The instructors know all of this, of course, which is why they stopped yelling early on. Instead, as the night wore on, Psycho Pete consoled us like a concerned older brother. He offered us hot soup, a warm shower, blankets, a ride back to the barracks. That was the bait he set for quitters to snap up, and he harvested helmets left and right. He was taking the souls of those who caved because they couldn't answer that simple question. I get it. When it's only Sunday and you know you're going to Friday, and you're already far colder than you've ever been, you're tempted to believe that you can't hack it, and that nobody can. Married guys were thinking, I could be at home cuddled up to my beautiful wife instead of shivering and suffering. Single guys were thinking, I could be on the hunt for pussy right now. It's tough to ignore that kind of glittering lure. But this was my second lap through the early stages of BUDS. I'd tasted the evil of Hell Week as part of Class 230. I didn't make it, but I didn't quit. I was pulled out on a medical after contracting double pneumonia. I defied doctor's orders 3 times and tried to stay in the fight, but they eventually forced me to the barracks and rolled me back to week one of Class 231. I wasn't all the way healed up from that bout of pneumonia when my second BUDS class kicked off. My lungs were still filled with mucus, and each cough shook my chest and sounded like a rake was scraping the inside of my alveoli. Still, I liked my chances a lot better this time around, because I was prepared, and because I was in a boat crew thick with bad motherfuckers. BUDS boat crews are sorted by height, because those are the guys who will help you carry your boat everywhere you go once Hell Week begins. Size alone didn't guarantee your teammates will be tough, however. And our guys were a crew of square peg misfits. There was me, the exterminator, who had to drop 100 pounds and take the ASVAB test twice just to get to SEAL training, only to be rolled back almost immediately. We also had the late Chris Kyle. You know him as the deadliest sniper in Navy history. He was so successful, the Hajis in Fallujah put an $80,000 bounty on his head, and he became a living legend among the Marines he protected as a member of SEAL Team 3. He won a Silver Star and 4 Bronze Stars for valor, left the military, and wrote a book, American Sniper, that became a hit movie starring Bradley fucking Cooper. But back then, he was a simple Texas hayseed rodeo cowboy who barely said a damn word. Then there was Bill Brown, a.k.a. Freak Brown. Most people just called him Freak, and he hated it because he'd been treated like one his whole damn life. In many ways, he was the white version of David Goggins. He came up tough in the river towns of South Jersey. Older kids in the neighborhood bullied him because of his cleft palate or because he was slow in class, which is how that nickname stuck. He got into enough fights over it that he eventually landed in a youth detention center for a 6-month stretch. By the time he was 19, he was living on his own in the hood, trying to make ends meet as a gas station attendant. It wasn't working. He had no coat and no car. He commuted everywhere on a rusted-out 10-speed bike, literally freezing his balls off. One day after work, he stopped into a Navy recruitment office because he knew he needed structure and purpose and some warm clothes. They told him about the SEALs, and he was intrigued, but he couldn't swim. Just like me, he taught himself, and after 3 attempts, he finally passed the SEAL swim test. Next thing he knew, Brown was in Buds, where that freak nickname followed him. He rocked PT and sailed through first phase, but he wasn't nearly as solid in the classroom. Navy SEAL dive training is as tough intellectually as it is physically, but he scraped by and got within 2 weeks of becoming a Buds graduate, when in one of his final land warfare evolutions, he failed reassembling his weapon in a timed evolution known as Weapons Practical. Brown hit his targets but missed the time, and he flunked out of Buds at the bitter end. But he didn't give up. No, sir. Freak Brown wasn't going anywhere. I'd heard stories about him before he washed up with me in Class 231. He had 2 chips on his shoulders, and I liked him immediately. He was hard as hell and exactly the kind of guy I signed up to go to war with. When we carried our boat from the grinder to the sand for the first time, I made sure we were the 2 men at the front, where the boat is at its heaviest. "Freak Brown," I shouted, "we will be the pillars of boat crew too." He looked over, and I glared back. "Don't fucking call me that, Goggins," he said with a snarl. "Well, don't you move out of position, son. You and me, up front, all fucking week." "Roger that," he said. I took the lead of Boat Crew 2 from the beginning, and getting all 6 of us through Hell Week was my singular focus. Everyone fell in line because I'd already proven myself, and not just on the grinder. In the days before Hell Week began, I got it into my head that we needed to steal the Hell Week schedule from our instructors. I told our crew as much one night when we were hanging in the classroom, which doubled as our lounge. My words fell on deaf ears. A few guys laughed, but everyone else ignored me and went back to their shallow-ass conversations. I understood why. It made no sense. How are we supposed to get a copy of their shit? And even if we did, wouldn't the anticipation make it worse? And what if we got caught? Was the reward worth the risk? I believed it was, because I'd tasted Hell Week. Brown and a few other guys had too, and we knew how easy it was to think about quitting when confronted with levels of pain and exhaustion you didn't think possible. 130 hours of suffering may as well be 1,000 when you know you can't sleep, and that there will be no relief anytime soon. And we knew something else too. Hell Week was a mind game. The instructors used our suffering to pick and peel away our layers, not to find the fittest athletes, to find the strongest minds. That's something the quitters didn't understand until it was too late. Everything in life is a mind game. Whenever we get swept under by life's dramas, large and small, we are forgetting that no matter how bad the pain gets, no matter how harrowing the torture, all bad things end. That forgetting happens the second we give control over our emotions and actions to other people, which can easily happen when pain is peaking. During Hell Week, the men who quit felt like they were running on a treadmill turned way the fuck up, with no dashboard within reach. But whether they figured it out or not, that was an illusion they fell for. I went into Hell Week knowing I put myself there, that I wanted to be there, and that I had all the tools I needed to win this fucked up game, which gave me the passion to persevere and claim ownership of the experience. It allowed me to play hard, bend rules, and look for an edge wherever and whenever I could until the horn sounded on Friday afternoon. To me, this was war, and the enemies were our instructors, who'd blatantly told us that they wanted to break us down and make us quit. Having their schedule in our heads would help us whittle the time down, by memorizing what came next. And more than that, it would gift us a victory going in, which would give us something to latch onto during Hell Week when those motherfuckers were beating us down. "Yo, man, I'm not playing," I said. "We need that schedule." I could see Kenny Bigby, the only other black man in class 231, raise an eyebrow from across the room. He'd been in my first Buds class and got injured just before Hell Week. Now he was back for seconds, too. "Oh, shit," he said. "David Goggins is back on the log." Kenny smiled wide and I doubled over laughing. He'd been in the instructor's office, listening in when the doctors were trying to pull me out of my first Hell Week. It was during a log PT evolution. Our boat crews were carrying logs as a unit up and down the beach, soaked, salty, and sandy as shit. I was running with a log on my shoulders, vomiting blood. Bloody snot streamed from my nose and mouth, and the instructors periodically grabbed me and sat me down nearby because they thought I might drop fucking dead. But every time they turned around, I was back in the mix, back on that log. Kenny kept hearing the same refrain over the radio that night. "We need to get Goggins out of there," one voice said. "Roger that, sir. Goggins is sitting down," another voice crackled. Then after a beat, Kenny would hear that radio chirp again. "Oh shit, Goggins is back on the log. I repeat, Goggins is back on the log." Kenny loved telling that story. At 5'10" and 170 pounds, he was smaller than I was and wasn't on our boat crew, but I knew we could trust him. In fact, there was nobody better for the job. During class 231, Kenny was tapped to keep the instructor's office clean and tidy, which meant that he had access. That night, he tiptoed into enemy territory, liberated the schedule from a file, made a copy, and slipped it back into position before anyone ever knew it was missing. Just like that, we had our first victory before the biggest mind game of our lives had even begun. Of course, knowing something is coming is only a small part of the battle, because torture is torture, and in Hell Week, the only way to get past it is to go through it. With a look or a few words, I made sure our guys were putting out at all times. When we stood on the beach holding our boat overhead or running logs up and down that motherfucker, we went hard. And during surf torture, I hummed the saddest and most epic song from Platoon while we waded into the Pacific Ocean. I hope the listeners and the readers have seen that movie. What a great movie.
Oh man, it was seriously one of the most epic movies of all time.
And that is like the ultimate scene, right?
Yes. Yes. So there were several scenes in this movie that I took along with me as fuel. And there was a time when Elias, so this, you know, Platoon's about Barnes and Elias. And there was a scene where Barnes couldn't stand Elias, and he ends up shooting Elias. And the platoon is taken off in a chopper, and, you know, Barnes told everybody that Elias was dead because he shot Elias, and Elias went down in the woods or in the jungle, and so he left him for dead. So they start taking off in these choppers, and Charlie Sheen looks out of the chopper and sees Elias, you know, he's been all shot up from Barnes, and the Viet Cong is chasing this guy through the jungle, and they're just shooting him. And you see this guy who's just trying to get to the chopper, and he's like, he's falling down, and they keep on shooting him. He keeps on getting up, and he's falling down. In the very last scene, you see William Dafoe, who is Elias. He's on his knees, and he raises his arms up in the air as the choppers are going overhead. And the Viet Cong kind of like shoot him in his back for his last times, and he kind of falls down on the ground. It's an epic scene, man, but it's just that music from that sound, you know, from the actual movie, man, it was just epic. And, you know, it just helped me out so much.
Yeah, but it helped you out not because of the drama, because it was kind of comedy. Like you were saying that you were doing that for your guys, right?
Right. I was doing it for my guys, but what it did, it went from comedy to almost – that song would almost like put them in a trance. I was like almost transforming their mind. So it went from being very funny to being almost like, all right, it's time to get to work now.
Hmm.
And so it became a very powerful song for us, or at least for my boat crew.
Yeah, for your boat crew, more than the other guys, right? Because, you know, everyone's stretched out in the ocean. It's really just your boat crew that can hear it.
Right, right. It got pretty loud, though.
Did everyone join in?
No, you know what? I think